You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
That's right, it's true. You are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM and streaming on the web at kopn.org. My name is Mike Hagan. Pleasure to be with you. My guest tonight is Dr. Ryan DeBow. Ryan is a research scientist, program scientist at the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation in New York. That is JDRF for short. We're going to learn about juvenile diabetes and what's happening at the JDRF to help people out. Let's not waste any more time. We will go right to him and say hello. Dr. Ryan DeBow, thanks for being on the program. I appreciate it.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's late there. Are you in New York City?
I live just outside the city in a suburb in New Jersey.
What is it?
I live in Dunellen, so I take the train, the Raritan Valley Line in every morning. It takes me about an hour to get into the office, but it's pretty easy.
Okay. All right. A little background, please, if you don't mind, for people who aren't familiar with you or with JDRF. How'd you get involved with the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually have been type 1 for about almost 30 years at this point. Almost immediately, my dad and my mom reached out, or they reached, you know, it's a little unclear to me how this exactly happened, but got me involved with JDRF, and we started participating in walks at a very young age. And I would go door-to-door fundraising for JDRF, and kind of been involved pretty much ever since then. I took a little break while I was in undergrad, but while I was back in grad school, got back involved. My dad had been doing the Rides to Cure for several years. We'd go watch him, and I started getting involved with the RIDE program while I was in grad school, and that's how I stayed involved. And then while I was doing my postdoc, my wife was pregnant, and I decided it was a good idea to try and contribute my expertise to trying to prevent and cure this disease. And so I applied to an opening at JDRF, and that's where I am today.
Okay. What sort of background in education-wise, did you have to undertake in order to get your position there?
Absolutely. So in undergrad, I majored in biology and minored in business, and that was at Lake Forest College. That's
sure.
A small private school in the
Chicago
area.
Chicago, yeah.
Yeah, which was great because I'm actually named after a Cubs player.
Ryan Sandberg, right?
Yeah.
Number 23,
yep, right.
One of the best second basemen of all time. He was fantastic. You know, it's funny because I never heard the name Ryan prior to Ryan Sandberg. And you're one of the few guys that I've met along the way that had that has the same name. And I was guessing that perhaps your mom and dad might have named you because of Mr. Sandberg there.
Yep, that's 100% correct. I went to a Cubs game very young. Born and raised a Cubs fan and a Bears fan, so it's been hard times for most of my life.
I know it, man.
As a fan.
Yeah, don't you know it.
But we had some stress relief, you know, a few years back when we finally won the World Series.
I tell you what, that was worth its weight. I tell you, I can still taste it. And I don't care how long it is. That was fantastic.
It was great. It was awesome. It was well worth the wait. So from there, after undergrad, I decided, you know, to go and get a master's. And so I did that at Rush University and did some practical work at Northwestern University. So I did all my didactic work at Rush and then mm-hmm. did some clinical rotations at Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I met my wife at the time, and we started dating. And it was very early in our relationship. And I told her, look, I'm going to go get a doctorate degree.
Mm-hmm.
I gave her a list of schools. And luckily, she also got into Wake Forest University for a different program.
Yeah.
And so that's where we headed. And at Wake Forest University, I did my PhD in molecular medicine and translational sciences. Did a lot of work in cancer research. Mm-hmm. And one of the side effects of cancer treatment or radiation in general is diabetes. It can be a type 2 diabetes as an effect of the radiation, because radiation is toxic not just to the cancer, but to everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we also noticed was that the microbiome was altered in those patients. And so that's kind of how I crossed over from type 2 to type 1, and then bringing in my personal desire to end the disease, and my personal attachment with it made it a good fit for both me and the organization.
What is type 1 diabetes for people who aren't familiar, and maybe the difference between type 1 and type 2?
Yeah, absolutely. So type 1 traditionally has been known as juvenile diabetes, mainly because historically it was predominantly diagnosed in children, you know, between the ages of, you know, 5 to 7, and then some in the teenage years. What we've actually learned recently is that there's a new population that we've identified as that had been inappropriately diagnosed as type 2. So when you go into type 2, type 2 is largely thought of as a lifestyle. There is a genetic component to it, and that's something that may not be readily available and known to the general population. But the difference is that type 2 generally can be treated with diet, exercise, and pills to help improve your insulin sensitivity. Insulin being the hormone that your pancreas will secrete to help break down the glucose or sugar that you eat after diet. In type 1, your body kills your pancreas's ability to do that. Your immune system destroys it. But interestingly, as I was getting to earlier, is that we're now learning that because the default treatment for type 2 diabetes is to, you know, treat with pills, and if that doesn't work and diet doesn't work, to go to insulin, is that some of those patients that were diagnosed in their 40s and 50s are actually type 1s. They're just not.
They just didn't know it.
They just didn't know it. And so what we're learning is that there's actually two distinct waves of onset. And so it's not really just juvenile diabetes anymore. And that's why part of the reason JDRF moved away from Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation to just JDRF and being type 1 focused.
I see. So what is it then? In other words, if you're not diagnosed with it and you have it, in other words, if a person feels fine, how would they know? I mean, do they still need to check blood sugar regularly or something? Or?
Yeah, so usually what happens in those individuals is they'll start being treated as a type 2, and that treatment won't work as it should. And so their blood sugar will still remain high, and they can end up in what's known as DKA, or diabetic ketoacidosis, and they end up in the hospital really, really sick. And DKA can actually kill. And so when that happens and they're just poorly controlled for a long time, the default for the physician is to go ahead and start insulin therapy, and insulin therapy will help them regulate their blood sugar back into the normal ranges and stay healthy.
Okay. All right. So it's an autoimmune disease.
Yes.
And for those unfamiliar with that, maybe briefly what an autoimmune disease and autoantibodies and that type of stuff.
Yep. So an autoimmune disease is when your own body attacks its native tissue. And so for me, for example, my own immune system, which is a really important thing to have, it helps you keep healthy, attack its own body. And when it does that, it ends up killing a tissue type that you normally would have functioning in a healthy individual. And for type 1 diabetes, that organ is the pancreas. And the pancreas secretes insulin to help, you know, break down the glucose you eat, but it also has other things that help you digest your food as well. So the exocrine pancreas is what we call that, helps produce several of those digestive enzymes, and then the endocrine portion of the pancreas helps produce insulin.
Okay. How about symptoms of T1D, as it's so called?
Yeah, so symptoms can be extreme thirst, weight loss, frequent urination, vomiting, something that I experienced. I experienced all those symptoms. And unfortunately, if you let it go too long and you get to the hospital, you can also be diagnosed in DKA, which can be life-threatening.
Mm-hmm. How do people, what's the onset like? In other words, with yourself, is there a particular age or is it different with everybody, or can you actually be born with it already in effect where it has to be discovered, you know, at a very young age?
So it's different for everyone. We see some waves. So you have that early childhood wave. So interestingly, recently my boss actually published a paper in which they characterized, and she really fought for, was to change diagnosis from just you're type one or you're not. So we've now got what we call four stages. So stage one would be you have the autoantibodies present, but no irregular blood sugar.
Mm.
Stage two would be you have the two autoantibodies present and some minor irregularities in your blood sugar.
Okay.
Stage three is what was traditionally known as type 1 diabetes. You've gone to the clinic and been diagnosed as having type 1 diabetes. So your blood sugar is high. You've got the autoantibodies and you need to start therapy. And then stage four is really long onset type 1 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, interestingly, if you find someone in stage one, you know, we have the autoantibodies to tell you that, you know, once you have two of them, you're pretty likely, most likely going to end up with type 1 diabetes at some point in your life. It doesn't tell you a whole lot about rate of progression.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have me and then another person showing up with two autoantibodies, the rate to actual clinical diagnosis can vary greatly.
Okay.
And so we've done a lot of work with, and my boss has really pioneered this in working with IBM Watson and trying to tease out using all the data differences between groups. And we should have some of that data coming out available to the public relatively soon. And interestingly, one of the theories is that maybe some of these adult onset individuals that have traditionally been thought of as type 2 diabetics is that they're just really, really slow progressors. And what can we learn from that? You know, the other option being maybe there's something in the environment that is triggering them to become type 1 at a later age even than traditionally thought about. So those are some of the answers we're trying to get to. And hopefully in the near future, we'll have those. And if they are just really slow progressors, what can we learn that helps them not become type 1 until they're adults that we can maybe use to our advantage in those patients that will progress more quickly?
Okay. So you were kind of talking there about causes. Is there a particular cause, or are there more than one, or has it been pinpointed? Maybe it's genetic. What's going on? Do we know?
So there is a genetic component. You know, historically, there is a large genetic component. So approximately 70% of people with that have type 1 diabetes had an HLA risk allele, which is part of your immune system.
Mm-hmm.
That is starting to change as we see non-traditional risk groups being diagnosed at higher and higher rates with type 1 diabetes. And interestingly, the disease incidence is increasing at such a rate that it can't just be explained by genetics. That's why we're starting to think about some of the things in the environment. I mean, the incidence is increasing at a rate that is not explainable by genetics. And so
really?
part of what I work on is looking at some of those things. You know, I'm directly responsible for microbiome research in type 1 diabetes, and as well as the viral vaccine portfolio. So we're thinking maybe there's some viruses that in those that are at risk can lead to autoimmunity in these individuals. And then also responsible for the neoepitope. So are there certain environmental stressors that lead to beta cells producing proteins that they wouldn't normally do just because they're under stress. And beta cells being the cells in the pancreas that are responsible for the production of insulin. And so interestingly, it's a multifactorial disease. And for any individual, those factors can be different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the reason it's been so difficult at developing a cure, because it is a very complicated and multifactorial disease.
I see. You mentioned IBM's Watson. For people unfamiliar, it's a supercomputer that was developed years ago and came to fame on Jeopardy, of all things, a number of years ago by just kicking everybody's ass, basically. But I do understand that it has been used oftentimes in medical situations over the last few years. Could you maybe talk a little bit about how you utilize that?
Yeah, so she's we've got a consortium of different groups that are feeding data into it from these cohorts of individuals that we follow from at risk and those with type 1 diabetes, and taking all the data that's been collected from them and looking for things that maybe can help stratify those patients and into different groups and identify things that maybe we're not thinking about as potential indicators of different groups.
Or risk factors as well.
Yeah, and risk factors. So one thing that we're preparing to launch is additional biotech companies and academics to also look at electronic health records to dig into this and see what things were not really, you know, it's impossible for the human mind to link all these things together like a computer can and see what we can identify.
Cool. All right, let's talk a little bit about treatment and cures. First of all, can it be reversed? Can T1D be reversed, or is it something that you just have to treat essentially for the rest of your life once it's diagnosed?
For most individuals, it's something you have to treat for the rest of your life.
Okay.
There are some protocols out there in which stem cell transplants or bone marrow transplants has done it, but that's really only used in people that have what we call brittle diabetes. And the reason for that is that given current standard of care, they just can't control it and they're having all types of complications. And the reason it's limited to this group is because a bone marrow match is not something that we can use on every individual with type 1 diabetes. And it's not, it also means immune suppression. So it's, You've taken care of the type 1 diabetes, but you're on lifelong immune suppression, and that can have its own complications.
Yeah.
So what we're really trying to work towards is a cure without that.
I see.
And
I was reading a little bit about your organization, and I know that they were at least played some role in developing what's called artificial pancreas technology. And there are a lot of things that are involved in that, including monitors and insulin pumps and stuff like that. Could you talk a little bit about that? I guess that is something that is necessary for the ongoing treatment.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I actually wear one. So, and our current CEO, who also has type 1 diabetes, really pioneered that program. And so the first one on the market was Medtronic's. It's called the 670G, and that's what I wear. And so what it does is it's a what we call a hybrid closed loop. And so so basically when you're asleep, what it does is it takes your blood sugar every 5 minutes, feeds it into an algorithm, and decides whether or not to administer a small dose of insulin above and beyond what you've programmed it to do just in the background at a basal rate.
On a regular basis, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and if you go and look, so what it'll do, you can press a little button on the pump and you can go look and you can see your CGM, which is your continuous glucose monitor, which feeds to the insulin pump.
So at any given moment, you can take a look at that and it'll show you what your current readings are.
Yep.
Wow,
and
cool.
It'll also show you if the algorithm is overriding what was programmed in. And it does that with a little purple dot at the top. And so this has been pretty revolutionary for the field. We just had the FDA approve another one from Tandem. So now we've got two on the market. And in the near future, what we're hoping to do, so I mentioned it at night, it's really, really great. But during the day, I still have to tell it that I'm eating. And what we're really trying to move towards is completely closing that loop. And that's going to require better algorithms, and potentially more input. So right now, rather than just blood glucose, maybe we need to include something like ketones or physical activity, et cetera, so that the algorithm can adjust to more than just one reading physiologically.
how long does it take? Like, for example, when you're eating, how long does it take before the monitor can actually recognize that it needs to do something? Like, in other words, you'd like it to notice automatically, right? But is it something that takes longer to show up in the blood? Is that why?
So there's a couple things there. So essentially, one, it depends on the food that I eat. Mm. So if I go and drink a Coca-Cola, a regular Coke, that's going to show up pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to spike my blood sugar pretty quick, which is really difficult for the monitor to keep up with.
Mm-hmm.
If we eat a fatty and high carb food like pasta,
mm-hmm.
that'll show up a little bit slower. Now, the CGM on top of that is kind of limited because you wear it on your body and it's not actually plugged into your blood. What it's reading is the fluids of your tissue.
Hmm.
And so it takes a little bit of time for the sugar to go from your blood into the peripheral tissues.
Yes.
And so there's a little lag there as well.
I see.
And so those are things that we're trying to improve on. The CGMs have gotten much, much better than they were. The current generation I'm on is better than the previous generation that I was on.
Hmm.
We have some implantable CGMs, so they're a little deeper in your body. And I am also wearing that, and that does a lot better job at picking up things more quickly. And so trying to get all these components to the point where they can operate more in sync with how your body would is going to be a key component to improving these systems.
Hmm. Okay, cool. What about stem cell research? You mentioned that a little bit earlier in our conversation.
Yeah, so we also have a replacement program, and it's really big there. And what they're really trying to do is find ways to encapsulate cells. And we actually had a major buyout in the T1D field where Semma Therapeutics purchased the rights to a protocol. And what they've been able to do is create beta cells using these types of cells. And now that we have that source and that protocol in place, now we got to find a way to encapsulate them and keep them alive.
Hmm.
And by encapsulate, I mean whether we macro encapsulate them and surround them with a biocompatible scaffold, or if we micro encapsulate them, those are questions that remain open. And the main thing being, can we keep the cells alive with oxygen, but keep the immune system out? And does the FDA require us to be able to retrieve everything that we put into the human body?
Mm-hmm. What about a person that has T1D and feels fine? Do they still need to check their blood sugar and take insulin?
Absolutely. You gotta really check. On a personal side note, that's something that I struggled with when I was a kid, is that I thought I knew everything, right? I thought I could tell when my blood sugar was high.
I could tell
when my blood sugar was low.
Uh-huh.
I was a teenager. I was invincible. And then you go to the doctor and you find out, oh, you were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's critically important, and I can't stress this enough, especially for complications, that you keep on top of your blood sugars and that you check and that you administer insulin in the manner that your doctor prescribes.
Okay. All right. Very good. Okay. A couple more for you here. Okay.
Yep.
What about genetic inheritance? If a person has T1D, is it more likely that their children may?
Yes. So that's something I mentioned in my intro. So I had my first son, and actually the at-risk population, so just in general, the general population, the risk for type 1 diabetes is 1 in 300, approximately.
Wow, that's quite a few.
Yeah. However, if you have type 1 diabetes, or a first-degree relative with type 1 diabetes, that risk is approximately 15 times higher.
Wow.
And so, like, my son has a 5-7% chance rather than a 1 in 300 chance.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. How old is your son, do you mind me asking?
Yeah, no, he's 2 years and 3 months.
Okay. And I imagine you being as on top of this as you are, you've already taken a look at his regular blood sugar or something like that. Was it something that you would look for at that age?
So there's a cohort of individuals in the U.S. that's run by TrialNet, and what they do, since he is my son and has a first-degree relative with type 1 diabetes, they will screen him starting at 2.5 years old. So that date is coming up.
Coming up, okay.
And that's just based on, with all the data they've accumulated now, when is the best time to screen and when do those autoantibodies start showing up? With that said, there are cases of type 1 diabetes that show up earlier than that. However, I am paying attention to his behavior and how frequently he's urinating, whether or not he's hungry. Something I always worry about as a father.
Okay. All right. Here's a question that came in from someone on the web. What's the risk for a twin if his or her twin has been diagnosed with T1D?
It's about the same as the first degree relative. Not every twin that has a twin with type 1 diabetes is going to get type 1 diabetes. And that goes to that at this point, the genetics are not 100%. A lot of people, most people with type 1 diabetes, although that's changing, have some sort of risk allele for it, but not everyone. And then also environmentally what you're exposed to.
Okay. All right. How about resources if people want to learn more? I'm sure there's quite a bit there at jdrf.org.
Yeah, there's quite a bit there. There are local chapters everywhere, so I would encourage individuals to look locally and see the events that they have. They like to do galas. They like to do walks, et cetera. There's also the National Ride program that takes place that my dad and I both do. This year we'll be riding in Wisconsin, as well as my good friend David. And also you can find ways to donate just to the National Center at www.jdrf.org. People are free to reach out. There's ways to contact us on there. And I think even the scientists' names are up there somewhere, and they can get a hold of us with additional questions.
Yeah, yeah. A little bit more about the walks and the runs. I know that's a big part of your fundraising.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, the walks and the rides. It's actually a bicycle ride type of stuff that you do. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah. So I did the walks growing up, and so go door to door and talk to people about, who I was and why I was doing it. I mean, that's a great, great program. It's a cornerstone of JDRF fundraising. And then, more recently than the walk, the ride program has started, and it's just a life-changing event. It's really something. And, I watched my dad do it for a long time. He did it for my sister and I, because my sister also has type 1 diabetes. And upon doing it, my first ride, it's something that I'll probably do the rest of my life. It's remarkable to see the people that go out there and do this, even with no connection to type 1 diabetes.
And there are rides like in different parts of the country, or there's different times of the year. There's one, two, three. How many of them?
So it varies by year, and the locations vary. But there's usually 4 to 6 rides a year.
Mm-hmm.
There's one in Saratoga this year. There's one in Amelia Island. There's one in Tucson. There's one in Grand Rapids, Michigan. There's one in Wisconsin, and I'm sure I'm missing one. And then Death Valley. Death Valley has been a cornerstone as well. That one didn't occur last year. They were doing renovations to the main resort that was accessible to that ride. But that's back this year. So, get involved. I encourage you to reach out to your local chapters. They usually have a local ride coach and a great group of people to get involved with. And you don't have to do the full 100 miles. That's something, a lot of people seem apprehensive at first. Oh, man, what if I train and I can't do the 100 miles? The support on the rides is great, and you can turn around at any point. But, once you get involved and you experience that, it's just, no matter how many miles you do, it's a great experience. And the fundraising is really critical to our mission at funding cure and treat research at JDRF.
What do you feel about a cure? Just kind of your opinion. Do you feel that you're close or nowhere near or somewhere in the middle?
I think we're closer than we ever have been. And I'll say that I don't know exactly when it's going to happen. I'm confident that it'll happen in my lifetime. I think, you know, we had a recent paper published and a recent study that showed that we, for the first time, could delay the onset of type 1 diabetes by 2 years, and that's a massive step forward. And we're doing more and more human trials, which is really critical. And so as we get to doing more and more human trials and really teasing out the biology that works in humans, not just in animal models, I think we're going to learn more and more. And I think we're getting closer and closer.
Wow, cool. All right, I've got one last question for you here. And it's sort of an interesting story. I was snooping around a little bit on the web, and I found a story from May of 2005, and it was on an Israeli medical site. And the headline says, Israeli researchers coax liver cells to produce insulin. Let me read really quickly this, just a clip from it, and then maybe you could comment on it. Implanted adult liver cells emulate the genetic makeup of the pancreas and produce insulin. Adult liver cells can be redirected to produce insulin in response to glucose levels, according to the results of an Israeli study released last week. The scientists at Tel Aviv's Sheba Medical Center have successfully modified liver cells to produce insulin that, when transplanted into mice, brought diabetes under control. The researchers hope that one day the method will allow the use of a diabetes patient's own liver to treat their condition. Is that sound like anything that has happened? That's 15 years ago, this article.
I will say this, that in our regeneration program, that is something that we're looking at, not so much for liver cells anymore, but transdifferentiating. So like I mentioned earlier on, the pancreas is made up of exocrine and endocrine cells.
Okay.
And the endocrine cells primarily being beta cells, and that's what's lost in type 1 diabetes.
Yeah.
What we're looking for now within that program are two things. Things that can help regenerate the beta cells that you have, because what we've learned is that even if you've had type 1 diabetes for 50 years, you likely have some beta cells still there. And so if we can stimulate those with a therapeutic to regenerate more beta cells and function, that's one way. We're also looking at transdifferentiation. What I mean by transdifferentiation is, can we get the exocrine pancreas, because they're cells of a similar lineage, to, can we coax those into becoming beta cells? Or ductal cells in the pancreas? Can we get those to change into beta cells? The other strategy we're taking is that if now that we can stage type 1 diabetes, and we've seen some results, positive results from this, is can we help the beta cells in early stage 1 or 2 survive and survive the initial insult. And so there was a recent publication that came out with Anash Shalev that showed that treatment with verapamil, which is a common hypertensive drug and has been given to lots and lots of individuals and is pretty well safe, deemed safe. And what was shown in these individuals, a small study, but when given, those that received the drug at 12 months had no additional loss of their ability to produce insulin.
Wow.
And so those are the types of things that we're doing. And we recently launched, and this can be found for any academic investigators, an RFA, not so much for survival, but can we target the beta cell specifically with some of these drugs that we know can help regenerate? Because, you know, when you go to regenerate something, the risk is always that you regenerate a cell population that you don't want to, and that can lead to cancer.
Yeah.
And so we've launched an RFA about novel strategies to target a payload of drug to just the beta cell. And we also had a workshop that I helped organize with Dr. Frank Martin at JDRF and Pat Killian. And we brought together industry leaders and academic leaders together to try and address this, and this RFA is hopefully going to bring together those same players or novel players into the field to do this, because we know we have some agents that can induce it, but we need to be able to limit that potency to the beta cell.
Wow, really cool stuff, man. Awesome. Well, hey, I'm so glad we had the chance to talk, Ryan, and I sure appreciate the work that you guys are doing there. Once again, on the web at www.jdrf.org. Anything you'd like to sort of wrap up with?
No, thanks a lot for having me, Mike. And if anyone visits the website and they have additional questions, I believe my email is up there. They can feel free to shoot me a question. And if I'm not the local JDRF resident expert in it, I can try and make sure that the person at JDRF that is can get back to them.
All right, very good. And just so you know, if you guys need a media platform, if you've got news or if you have anything that you want to share with the public, just get a hold of me and let me know and we'll get you back on the air.
That sounds great. Thanks a lot, Mike.
All right, Ryan, you take care of yourself. I appreciate you calling late at night.
You too. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, that's Dr. Ryan DeBoe. He's a research scientist at the JDRF Institute. They are studying type 1 diabetes and doing very good work in the challenge to come up with a cure for that particular disease that affects quite a few people, 1 in 300 in the general population. And if you're related to somebody, those odds go up dramatically. So anyway, great work and appreciate the stuff that's happening over there at JDRF. Once again, on the web, jdrf.org. You can also find them on Twitter, et cetera. And yeah, thanks to Ryan for taking the time to come on the show. All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, streaming on the web at www.kopn.org. Let's hear one from our featured musicians of the evening. They're called the Kitchen Dwellers.